Our moderator today is the chief executive officer of 1871. And I could tell you that he's described as the godfather of Chicago's tech scene and the public face of Chicago's community. But I want to just tell you, in the years I've known Howard, he's actually a hero of mine. And why? Because Howard is living his mission. He's having a lot of fun. He's making the world a better place. And he's doing, in my opinion, from having known him, exactly what he wants to do to help the world. So, ladies and gentlemen, Howard Tolman. Howard, you're on.
Thank you, Jay. And I'm glad to be back at the City Club. So a couple of logistical announcements, and please keep eating and save me just a few of the cannolis, if you would. So Rishi Shah, who is our third panelist, is on a plane. I think it's landed, and he's on his way here. But we've tricked Adam Heckman from Microsoft to join the panel in the meantime. And so we're going to bring up the panelists in a couple of minutes. But I just wanted to start by saying that the origin of this particular program, and I'm hopeful that we'll do a few more of these, was to find some areas that are important. And so the areas were obviously education and business automation and healthcare. Find some companies that had roots or connections, very close connections to 1871, purely out of self-interest. But nonetheless, people ask us all the time, how are you doing? What are you generating? What kind of businesses are you creating? And, you know, part of our job at 1871 was job creation as a nonprofit. And we've created over 8,000 jobs. We have now about 500 companies at 1871. Thank you. And just to be clear, those companies have raised over $250 million. They've really helped to put the city and, Chicago overall on the map in many, many respects. So job creation, we've expanded what's going on at 1871 in a variety of ways. But the real bottom line was, how can we help the city grow overall? And the goal going forward, and the reason this forum is so important, and that I wanted to focus on up-and-coming and sort of next-generation businesses, is it's not enough to have a bunch of startups. They're not going to move the needle. It's how do we connect those startups to our enterprise customers, to the big companies in Chicago, because they have to change too. You know, change is not hard. It turns out that what's hard is overcoming the resistance to change, and people are really happy with what's worked for them in the past. And the frightening thing is it's not going to work in the future. It's just not going to be the way the world works. So people don't change when they see a light bulb go off, notwithstanding all the cartoons and, you know, the publications notwithstanding. They change when they feel the heat, when things get to be inevitable. And so one of the things that's really important is connecting and the matchmaking and the way we combine the younger companies at 1871 and all the technologies and the new ideas with where we're headed among the big companies. When 1871 started in May of 2012, the tech sector in our quite diverse economy in Chicago, you'll hear the mayor say all the time, is a very distributed economy. No single sector is more than 12 or 13% of the economy, but tech was about 2% in 2012, and today it's almost 13%, and that's, again, a product of the fact, A, the creation of new jobs and new companies, but B, the Mart and the city has become an attractor, so ConAgra and Caterpillar and all these organizations are, A, moving here to be close to the hub and these new technologies, B, growing here, and even the companies that are being acquired, and we've had some amazing exits. We've had multi-billion dollar exits, so Fieldglass and Cleversafe and a variety of other organizations, they're staying. And the funds that are being generated by those exits are being repurposed and reinvested. And this is, again, part of, you know, what makes Chicago so special, that the people don't just look forward, they also look backwards and extend a hand backwards to the up-and-coming people. So this was a chance to show you and to have you see a little bit of the future in terms of these important areas. Areas where we want to make these connections, and some of these connections may be companies sitting right here. And I think that, you know, the last thing that's really significant is that we have to make sure, and this has been a big mission at 1871 as well, that it's not just a downtown phenomenon, that it's not just something that happens at the Merchandise Mart, but it's something that we figure out how to spread through the city, throughout the whole city, so that everybody participates in this inclusive idea of change and improvement and how technology is going to make the world better. So having you know, the folks here who are here and having them have a chance to explain to you how they're helping to do all of that is really what this is about. So I'm going to start by introducing our panelists. So Eileen Murphy taught English for 15 years and was the founding English department chair at Walter Payton, which is now what? Is it number one in the world, or is it the number? It's pretty high, I think. So if you don't know, I mean, the Chicago schools on a national ranking, just off the charts now. I think we have number one and number three in the United States. So huge, huge, I hate to use that word, I guess. But anyway, so she's an author, she's an educator, she was in charge of curriculum at CPS and instruction for the 100 of the most important CPS schools, highest performing schools, and then she changed and became a tech entrepreneur. And so her company, Think Circa, is a company that's helping to change the way kids learn. You know, teaching kids in the age of Google to memorize is, you know, doing them an active disservice. It's stupid. And so, you know, her premise and her idea was to create a curriculum and ideas around evidence-based learning, how to teach kids to assemble evidence, assemble arguments, make arguments, present their cases. And when you do this, you discover that the kids really take ownership of their learning in really exciting ways. So Eileen is here to tell us about Think Circa. So Eileen, why don't you come on up? And I think she may have been at 1871 for some portion of her early formative years. Sean Chow is here from Catalytic, and Catalytic is really near and dear to my heart because, you know, we think that business automation is among the lowest hanging opportunities for just about every company in the world, but certainly in Chicago. And 1871, when it started, I think that if you were a pet dating site, we would probably find a place for you, although today, not so much. So we've morphed because we think it's important to focus on how do we provide and build companies that are B2B, business to business, to help businesses improve the way they do business. And Catalytic is all about bots, which I think people say, gee, I'm not sure I understand what a bot is. Sean will tell us a little bit about that. But the real key is pretty simple. It takes about 15 hours for us at 1871 to take a new employee from walking in the door to being fully connected with a ID card and on the insurance program and all of these different things. And when you multiply that in large organizations, it's hundreds and thousands of hours that these new systems and these new automated tools eliminate. And so J.P. Morgan not too long ago announced that using some of these systems, they're going to eliminate 360,000 hours of legal time in contract review. They announced that in their IT departments, they're going to eliminate 1.4 million internet accesses. That's about 140 jobs. Now, we have to figure out what to do with all of this displacement, and it's not one-to-one, and it's not that we're getting rid of redundant jobs and we're going to all be wonderfully creative workers and have a happy future. These are big issues for the whole country. But automation is something that's unavoidable. And what they're doing at Catalytic is building these tools for large organizations to take some of the old ways of doing business and convert them into new systems that are efficient, that replace redundant and repetitive work, and that are flawless in terms of execution, which I think is another important part of that. So Sean used to be at a company that was one of our most successful exits, and he was the EVP of services and I think the founding CTO as well at Fieldglass, which was recently acquired by, let me guess, IBM maybe, or SAP, one of those. And he's going to talk about just this idea of how these new processes have to be changed and improved in order to help companies be more competitive and particularly be more efficient. So, Sean, ciao. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about Rishi Shah, who hopefully will appear soon. But and then I'll tell you a little bit about Adam Heckman as well, who I know for a fact is here. So that has a certain charm to it. So Rishi is the CEO and the co-founder of something now called Outcome Health, used to be called Context Media, just completed raising about $600 million. And this is a company that never before had taken any outside capital, to give you an idea. And I don't think, Claudia, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think Rishi or Shraddha are 30 yet, right? Or they're close? Pretty close. Anyway, two 30-year-old Northwestern dropouts, but go Northwestern nonetheless, who have been working. This is one of these, you know, overnight successes, 12 or so years on this business. But what they figured out was that we spend more time by far in the waiting rooms of doctors' offices than we do with the doctor. And so they provide information, very significant, valuable information with respect to patient diseases and medications and things in the waiting rooms. And then a couple of years ago, they decided that they could also use a lot of this new technology, a lot of these new monitors and things, to help the doctors in the examining rooms do a better job of explaining to all of us what's going on with these various medical conditions. So they've deployed those in, I think they interact with something like 500,000 patients every quarter or something like that, some staggering number. Super successful, great story, and hopefully he'll be here and tell us about that journey, but more importantly about where we're going with healthcare. And my particular interest there is in telemedicine, because, you know, increasingly it's clear that most of us, when we finally get to the doctor after waiting a couple of weeks and the condition has generally gone away by then, and you sort of felt like, you know, if you could have helped me when I needed it, it would have been one thing, but, you know, now the cold is over. So, but if we could do that on our phones, about 60 or 70% of the time, we wouldn't have to go to the doctor. So an interesting thing, because these models change that quickly in the world of these new technologies. And then I'm going to ask Adam Heckman to come up. Adam has been with Microsoft almost forever, I think, and is involved in and has served in a variety of different roles at Microsoft, but now is principally, you know, principally one of the Microsoft liaisons to the community, to the civic activities that Microsoft does. And, you know, I'm sort of subbing in smart cities and everything that's going in around the way that the city is being rewired and changed. And we're going to ask Adam to tell us a little bit about the companies that he's working with, the companies that he's seeing, and the new emerging technologies in that space. And if you don't know, for example, the mayor just recently announced that we're replacing all the streetlights in the city of Chicago. This is pretty astonishing, actually, with new LED lights, and they'll be connected to the grid, and they'll have connections and sensors and things on them, which will permit the whole city to be adjusted and dealt with in a highly efficient way, in a really interesting way. And those will be tools to permit the city to get smarter about all kinds of services that are going to be delivered and developed. And the data flowing from all that stuff is going to create, you know, whole new realms of information and opportunity as well. Okay, so that's sort of the predicate. And why don't we start, Eileen, could we start with you and just tell us a little bit about ThinkCirca?
Okay. Sure. So ThinkCirca is a platform that teachers and school district and school leaders use to personalize literacy instruction. And literacy is sort of a fuzzy word for a lot of people, but think about the reading and writing skills that you use every day when you search Google and think critically about whatever complex text appears before you, and then eventually try to translate that into an email. Imagine what your life would be like if you couldn't do that. And unfortunately for the U.S., we have a big problem, which is that only about 34% of the students in third grade in the U.S. are actually achieving grade-level literacy. And only about 27% of high school graduates are actually at a high school graduate level of their ability to write. And so in a world where these skills I would consider a basic civil right, and in fact there's actually a U.S. Supreme Court case about this, making the argument that it is a basic civil right to be able to read and write in the 21st century. And that's what we do, is we just ensure that on a very large scale we can teach all humans how to do these really complex things in a more standardized way so that we don't leave a bunch of a billion people behind.
Great, great. Sean?
I feel so shallow now. try to rethink how I'm going to talk.
She's
about
just fixing
you.
A billion people. You certainly you've got to come up with something there.
All right. Well, so automation is a scary word. I realize that. But, you know, we really think of our goal as giving back some time to you and to your team so that you can do more of what you actually want to do and a lot less of those kind of drudgery type of things that have creeped in almost in every single bureaucratic process that you can imagine. So our platform is really an intelligent technology layer that does three things. It helps guide your team through their business processes. It helps automate a lot of the more mundane type of tasks that you might do, and this is like a wide spectrum of different types of tasks. It could be simple things, it could be a little bit more cognitive things, so this is where AI and machine learning come into play. And then the third thing we do is we really connect to a lot of your systems, because in a lot of business processes, you're either pulling data from or pushing data into systems. So we think of what does it actually take to have a very, very complex process or simple processes, but what will it actually take to make this a truly seamless, optimized, and highly automated kind of, you know, process. Our ideal customers are really frontline business users, and we typically try to get them set up, and I think they can actually set themselves up typically in a few days. So that's okay. It in a nutshell.
Okay. And Adam, I'm interested in automation as it relates to sort of cities and smart cities.
Right. So the concept of smart cities has been around for actually a very long time, decades. You're hearing more about it now, partially because of companies like Sean's, also partially because you have sensors that are low cost, that are putting out an unprecedented amount of data, and you have technologies like cloud technologies that are making it very inexpensive to do something with that data. So when you combine the data, the cloud, and technologies like the bots that Sean was talking about, you suddenly have the ability to do things with a city that you weren't able to do before. Analyzing exactly why flooding happens in some areas and not others. You had mentioned the streetlights. Optimizing those streetlights so that they're on when they need to be on, they're off when they need to be off, and reducing the costs. Public safety, energy, transportation, physical infrastructure. There's some great opportunity to do stuff now, but it only became possible when all of those other pieces that I mentioned came together.
So are these sort of new tools being built by startups, or are they being built by larger organizations? And are the larger organizations just so stuck in the traditional ways of doing business that it's going to be a, a decade or two before they wake up to these things?
The answer to all of your questions is yes.
Yes.
Let me give you an example. At 1870,
do you have $40 I could borrow?
Well, since I'm Rishi Shah, I got $3.2 billion
okay.
that you can borrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's not here, so I can say that. Well, you take a look at, like, in 1871, we have Bosch opened up their connectory downstairs on the fifth floor. The connectory is Bosch's space where they are looking at, where they're hosting startups that are looking at, you know, sensors and how to do things with Internet of Things. And one of the many reasons that Bosch, which is an older company, did this was partially so that they could have access to IP of some of the things that the startups are looking at, but they also wanted to look at how startups work. They wanted to see face-to-face what kinds of things they do, what their processes are, what they can learn from it, that they can incorporate, you'd mentioned looking forward and backward, what they can incorporate backward into their own enterprise.
Okay, good.
Go ahead. Chime in. So something fascinating has happened in corporate America in like the past, I don't know, 10 years or so. When we started Fieldglass, you know, it seems like at like the dawn of internet time in 2000, the interaction between large companies and small companies was not there, right? I mean, large companies largely viewed small companies as a nuisance, something to be ignored until they could no longer be ignored. But what I'm seeing now is pretty remarkable. It's actually like an unprecedented level of interaction. And I see a lot of large companies fully embracing startups as a source of innovation, as opening their doors, letting them come in. And like I was just actually talking to one of the largest CPG companies, and you know the team that we were talking to, they were telling us that they're actually paid as a team by the number of paid pilots that they conduct with startups. And this like blew my mind. I mean, you know, 20 years ago that would have been a laughable concept, but today it's like commonplace, which is amazing. So it really does show like this interaction and collaboration between large companies and small companies.
Well, one of the reasons, you know, for that is that for like the last decade, a lot of these companies went to sleep internally on R&D. That was how they saved a lot of money. And I think they think that startups now represent a M&A way that they can catch up, that they can watch startups. And that's sort of off balance sheet, so they don't have to hire people to pursue those.
But then, as you can imagine,
that's right. But then they can invest in companies when they start to develop things. You know, Bosch describes it as outside in innovation, that they actually said, we want to look at 100 companies. We want 25 to make the first smell test. We want 5 to be internally adopted for pilots. And then maybe one or two of those ideas, but at least they're open to it. And within their own organizations, they can't field the teams, they can't pay the money, they can't really do that. So,
yeah.
I think the other thing about the relationship between larger companies and startups is that, you know, startups exist because they have some intimate knowledge of the problem mm-hmm. that they're trying to solve. And often, you know, big corporations get removed farther and farther from the problem that they may have originally solved. And so in our case, several of our investors are actually strategic investors who are large companies that our partners. So Follett, which is another local company, 140-year-old family-owned company that has gone through so many evolutions, and they invested in Think Circa because they wanted to move from other parts of the school district and colleges into classroom instruction, and found us, invested in us, and now are a distribution partner for us. So it's a really mutually beneficial relationship.
So, Eileen, let me ask you this. So much of education now is going on outside of the classroom. Is there a strategy for you to make your tools and your methodology available to parents that just want to help their kids become these? I think of them as mini debaters. It's not like I argue enough with my granddaughters. But I mean, that's what I think the methodology is all about, and it's an exciting thing. And I'm just curious as to how parents react to it.
Yeah, well, we can ask Sean because I'm going to give him a login for his three kids.
Well, I was just thinking when you were describing what you did, I was like, I don't know if my 9-year-old needs to get any better at it. I'm not quite sure I want him to get any better than he already is.
So yeah. just to be clear, I went to visit my granddaughters like last week, and they had each prepared a PowerPoint presentation on why they needed a new iPad.
So, all right.
So one's coming.
These are 12-year-olds, right?
Well, and that just goes to show, I mean, really in entrepreneurship, the most important skill you really have is your ability to reel other people into your big idea.
Storytelling
and making a clear argument. And so Think Circa, the Circa in Think Circa stands for Claim, Evidence, Reasoning, Counterargument, Audience. And so in the U.S., we decided that the most important thing we could teach people to do is how to consume information, think about it critically, and express their point of view effectively. And all of our standards across the country and all of our assessments now align to those 21st century skills. And I would say that what we really promote is the ability, it's career, college, and civic readiness. So as far as using Think Circa outside of the classroom, we actually are in the process of building a tool for exactly that purpose. And I have to tell you, we had a flood of requests for such a thing in early November, as you can imagine.
Sure.
But the engagement with current events and really, you know, and we were actually cited by the World Economic Forum as a promising socio-emotional learning tool because of our ability to allow people to engage with each other, sometimes disagree, and still have that be okay and actually have people value that because they've now gotten a more rich perspective and are okay with the fact that they might still disagree.
Yeah. I think that when people ask what's the most significant skill to teach kids who unfortunately think that a search tool like Google is objective, which it clearly isn't objective, I think that this idea of a second source, and that's really what part of your, you know, you sort of zip through the five components, but yeah. Talk just a little bit more about that idea of the counterarguments and how it opens us to understanding that you can't take anything for granted these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the events of the past week, and unfortunately so many of the past weeks, show we really have to, and language is really the resource. It is an incredibly powerful tool that can be used for good and evil. And, you know, often education has created an elite group who controls language to a great extent. And then often remediation, which is applied to especially high poverty areas and maybe communities that are marginalized, they get like a watered down version of education. And what we decided to do was, you know what, you know, deciding whether or not we should have driverless cars or if drones can fight our wars more ethically, that's something that everyone should be able to think about and have the language skills and the critical thinking skills to engage in, because it's an important topic for all of us. So the way we do it is we provide 10 levels of differentiation around the same big question, like, you know, is technology good or bad for us? And every student who is in that classroom, like at DuSable High School, for example, where there could be a third grade level reader and a kid who's probably written their own novel, all in the same classroom with one teacher, and that teacher now has the power to meet all of those needs and engage those very different perspectives in a way that levels the playing field. And I think the more we can do that as just as a country, where people who don't have the same level of educational attainment can actually participate and have kind of the same credibility in a conversation would change the game. I think the inclusion and diversity in decision making is a big component of what we try to instill. And as we reach more and more students, we're currently in 38 states, used in 132 countries. And as an industry, education is exploding. It's one, I think, the sixth largest component of the global economy. We obviously have ambitions to go global and to empower as many people as we can with the ability to interact with other people well.
Great. So, Sean, let's talk a little bit about automation in the sense that, you know, Amazon has just announced new stores that have no cashiers.
Yeah.
And if we didn't feel bad enough for cashiers to begin with, let me just say there are about 11 million cashiers in the United States,
yeah.
More cashiers than we have teachers.
Yeah, the number one job as driver.
Right.
Actually.
Right. Yeah. So what are we going to do, and what's the strategy that's as we eliminate these tasks and automate these tasks? What is your feeling about how do we? You said it gives us more time, and one of the interesting things I would like you to think about as well is, in the context of education, Eileen probably or Adam knows this number, but teachers spend 30 or 40% of their time keeping score and taking admission and doing stupid things instead of teaching. And for sure, you have to be in a position to be creating the kind of tools that can help in that space as well.
Yeah. It's a tough question, right? Because we tend to think of it in a very, like, almost a microscopic sense. So we're looking within a company and we're looking for the opportunities for improvement. But, of course, in the backdrop of all of this, in our minds, is very much, well, what happens to all of the people? In a smaller company, when we go into, it's not a displacement story, because a lot of times it really is I'm growing rapidly. I have 100 people. Next year I want to double my top line growth, but I want to double the number of people that I need to get that done. So that's actually a little bit of an easier story, because it's kind of a foregone opportunity. When we get into larger companies, and now they have the initiatives, they have the mandate to cut 5% out of their bottom line, or add 5% to their bottom line by cutting out some inefficiencies. You know, in our minds, we do know that lives are being impacted and jobs are being lost as a result of this automation. And I think that's a much longer discussion to really get into it in a meaty sense. But I think there are very profound societal and cultural impact. And you could say that historically this has happened. Right, like when electricity came in, lots and lots of jobs would have been displaced, or mass manufacturing would have displaced a lot of these kind of artisanal or craftsman type jobs. But what's different this time around is the rate of change. Right, if you look at electricity, that took a lot longer for that to kind of trickle through all of society. Now, with automation, with AI and machine learning, you're seeing that impact. It's going to happen not within just one generation, within kind of, within a short blink of an eye to us. I mean, I think...
And each change accelerates the rate of the change
totally.
As well.
I mean, a lot of people forget, like, the iPhone is 8 years old. So in like, 2010, 2008, there was no iPhone. And in that short period of time, think about the profound change. I mean, there are books and bookstores that talk about people addicted to their iPhone. As I sit here holding my iPhone, there are books talking about addictions to iPhones. It's like had this profound societal and cultural impact. So I wish I had like a tight answer for what we do with all those, but it would be,
I'm going to come to Adam in a second, but I mean, I think, you talk about your phone. I mean, I think we're in this really scary context now where the acceleration of the technology is running so far ahead of our social institutions and our laws and our regulations. And we know that the technology we're dependent on it, but we also know that we don't exactly control it. And if you ever lose your phone for as much as an hour or two, you understand the degree of connection and dependence. But Adam, talk for a little bit about also what Microsoft is doing in the ed space.
Right. Well, before I do that, let me just add to something that Sean said. The solution, there is not a single solution to this, but I do think part of the solution is thinking through how you enable people whose jobs are going to be displaced with middle skills. Middle skills are those skills that you can acquire that are marketable that don't require a four-year degree. Howard was something of a pioneer in this space before it became the issue that it became now, with Kendall College and Tribeca Flashpoint, and now with 1871. So if you think about what it takes to get a four-year degree, it's time and it's expense. You take a look at some of the things, like some of the things we do at 1871. We have boot camps like Full Stack, where instead of going for years to school, you go for several months and you walk out and you're able to be a web developer, and a bunch of the other boot camps that are there, that's Evolved and a few others. In the city of Chicago, we have a gap right now of 10,000 jobs. Am I out?
No, keep going. Okay. Slide over.
Get in the boot.
Slide over.
So, so, So Rishi has a flair for the dramatic entrance. So, speaking of which, so in the city of Chicago right now, we have a gap of 10,000 jobs that are going to go unfilled in the cybersecurity space, right? And that's going to be a gap that nationwide is 1 million people a year per year for at least the next 5 years. But guess what? There's a lot of jobs in the cybersecurity space that don't require a four-year degree. So what the mayor did was he worked with the Department of Defense and Wilbur Wright College so that you can take this very concentrated, inexpensive curricula and walk out with a certificate that enables you to participate in that economy.
Right. So just before I reintroduce Rishi, who we greatly appreciate, just literally hopped off a plane and came back from out of the city to make this appearance with us. I think that the one of the interesting things is we keep calling it a four-year degree, and the fallacy starts there, because it's not that I spent 4 years with my butt in a seat. It's a question of when and over what period of time did it take me to master the skills that it takes to be able to do the job or become employable. And you know, as long as we stigmatize vocational education, which are perfectly wonderful middle-class jobs in many respects, we're never going to fix that part of the problem. I had a plumber at my house recently, and he charges, $110 an hour or something. I said, that's more than my doctor charges. He said, when I was a doctor, I charged less than that, too. Anyway, sorry. All right, so Rishi, that was actually a segue into healthcare. There you go. There you go. So tell us a little bit about Outcome Health.
Well, first of all, Howard and the City Club, thank you so much for having me. I'm so sorry I'm running late. I was all scheduled to be here this morning and then had a delay. But this is the best-looking Rishi Shah I've ever been. So Outcome Health is a great company. We started almost a decade ago now, headquartered here in Chicago. And it's at the intersection of health and technology. And we had a counterintuitive approach at first, at least counterintuitive in the industry. It was pretty intuitive to us because healthcare was pretty personal growing up. My father is a physician. My sister has diabetes, and I've kind of lived around it. And growing up, I never thought I would want to work in healthcare. I was always interested in tech. But around the time I was in college, my co-founder, Shraddha Agarwal, and I both thought, how great would it be to actually insert technology into the doctor's office where and when decision-making is happening. So, you know, one of the funny thing is for people who have a chronic condition, you know, where 80% of our healthcare expenditures are, they'll live with their condition all year long, but they'll spend maybe an hour of FaceTime with their doctor over that whole year and make most of the critical decisions. Now, in that room, it's like the Twilight Zone. There's nothing from the last 30 years in there. You have, you know, plastic models for the anatomy. You've got posters and wall boards. And so we've actually put in now hundreds of thousands of our own devices, our own technology, and we're trying to bring digital information and ultimately intelligent applications that can help patients and doctors collaborate in making the best decision possible to get to the best outcome possible. And we're still a small startup in our eyes because we want to be in every exam room in the world, over 10 million, and we're in just over 100,000. So we have a ways to go.
Great. Why don't you talk about telemedicine?
Yeah, well, you know, telemedicine is a subject that we think a lot about, actually. You know, it helps sometimes to look 10 years out, right? Because you get a first principled view sometimes of what should exist if you were starting from scratch even today, because that's how long sometimes it can take. And so when you think about healthcare, you know, it often comes down to these interactions between doctors and patients. And it's not clear to me that they always should be in person. If you have a population that you're caring for as a primary care physician or a cardiologist or an endocrinologist, and you said you can start from scratch, you know, how would you like to interact with your population to achieve the best outcomes? You'd probably like to manage your population the way many of you might manage your teams. There are some conversations you need to have in person. There are some conversations you might want to have in groups with their care teammates, whether they're your peers as other doctors or educators, or even their caregivers and family members. So telemedicine, we think, is going to really start driving that type of coordinated approach. The key is whether it's physical or it's virtual, right? I mean, you can have all kinds of virtual rooms. For now, a lot of them are just phone calls, actually. The majority of telemedicine is still phone-based. But whether it's video, whether it's virtual rooms, the key is how do we lever up the intelligence that's there? So your clinical data as an individual, your preference maps can be contextualized against all available information on a network. And so I think that's what telemedicine is all about. We're just scratching the surface. Today, the most successful telemedicine companies are in acute. So if I am not feeling well, I can quickly call somebody and figure out whether it's serious, whether it's not, do I need this kind of prescription or that kind of prescription.
It's all triage.
Right, it's triage. What we really need to do is if I have cancer, if I have heart disease, if I'm dealing with real chronic conditions, how do we bend the outcomes curve there using technology and this coordinated approach? And we're just getting started there, but we think that's where all the improvement's going to be.
All right, so I have a question here, and I want to remind everybody we have about 15 minutes or so. If you have any questions, please get them to Bob or pass them forward. This turns out to be for Rishi, so once again, Rishi, unbelievably timely arrival. Is your company's offering transferable into international markets? And if so, what markets offer the most opportunity?
Yes, we believe it is. And, you know, despite my instincts where I just say anything to anyone anytime, I probably can't break news today on which international market we will expand into first and next. But we actually really think this is a core issue around the world, right? Whether you're in India, which is where my parents are from, or you go to Canada, or you're in Europe, or you're in Latin America, frankly, the doctor's office is the one thing that hasn't changed much. You know, you go into the exam room, and you see brochures, you see posters, and you can be talking about the most important decisions of your life, and you have paper reference materials. And so we think this is a need that's really abundant everywhere. And actually, internationally, there's a more ripe market in some ways because of payer concentration. You know, when you look at healthcare, one of the reasons it's such a difficult space is fragmentation. Providers and doctors' offices are very fragmented, so you have to go pick them up one by one, aside from some big systems. And even there, they're very decentralized. They work almost like universities, as some of you might know. So everyone makes their own calls, really. And then, you know, the more dangerous fragmentation is the economic fragmentation. If Adam's my doctor, we both want to make the right decision, but we're not usually the economic principals of those decisions. The economics flow to the payer, to all the life science companies, the goods, the services. And in our country, the payers are all fragmented too, which there's some good and bad too. Internationally, it's much more concentrated. So the winner is clearer. And so we think that's one of the perks. Now, there are other regulatory frameworks as well. So it's a two-way street there.
Okay. So, Adam, I have another question here, which is related to the Chicago River and the Riverwalk, which is increasingly become a major benefit and sort of a usable space for everyone. And the question is really, what kinds of technology and technological innovations could help even improve the value and the reach? And I don't know whether this is, I know the gondola project, and there's some other things, lighting up the buildings along the Riverwalk is something that's going on. But just talk to us a little bit about what you see there.
Yeah, you know more about the river than I do, it
right.
Sounds like. But the opportunity, it's bigger than just spaces, which is important, having spaces that you can use and you can share and you can enjoy and you can build businesses around. It's also around the infrastructure and the types of things that you take for granted. There's opportunities to apply technology to places where technology has been rudimentary at best. There's a consortium called City Digital. It's out of UI Labs. And what they think about is how you can take sensors and data and apply it to some of the really big, seemingly intractable problems around water, energy, physical infrastructure, and transportation. I'll give you an example that's sort of related to the river. We sort of kind of know what's underground here. We don't really know what's underground. And it's very expensive, and it creates a lot of carbon in the air when you go and break something. Comcast needs to go and repair something, and they open it up, and boom, they run into a 110-year-old telegraph cable, right? So we're, at UI Labs, at City Digital, they're working on a project where every time the ground is opened up, you take some pictures, you send those pictures down electronically to a startup down at University of Illinois who puts it into a very specific point cloud and then brings it back, and you have all of these 3D images now of what's underground. We have 2D images, but it turns out that that third D is pretty important when you're digging. And the reason it's important to have this digital is not just so that you can avoid these problems, there's security, right? If I'm People's Gas, I want ComEd to know where my assets are. If I'm AT&T, I want to know where People's Gas and ComEd's assets are. I don't want ISIS to know any of that, right? So once it's digitized, it can also be secured. Apply that to any piece of infrastructure in the city, like the river, the gondolas, transportation. You will get to understand the opportunity.
So, Sean, talk about security in terms of, as these processes are increasingly automated, we have less and less sort of overview of what they're actually doing. You know, this is sort of Skynet, right? But so talk about how businesses are going to maintain control and assure security, but take and sort of reap the benefits of these automations.
Yeah, well, we may have just formed the thesis for what the majority of all the people who are being displaced should be learning and the new skills that they should be gaining, because that certainly will be one of the biggest challenges as more and more of our day-to-day lives move into the digital world. I think on one hand, it does offer up an iota of security. So you could make the case that it's more secure to have it as a digital asset than, let's say, a bunch of books in a library. But I think it's actually just as easy to make the reverse case, and I think more common, in fact, to make that reverse case. So security is unsurprisingly one of the largest growing segments of, I think, what the entire world is paying attention to. Digital security is a huge part of that. Interestingly, one of the processes that we often talk a lot about is exactly around security. So a lot of security failures are not at the infrastructure level, they're at the people level. And when we look at what those failures are, they're often a failure in process. And like one of the most common ones actually is an offboarding process. I'm sure half this room has had an auditor flag their company somewhere because they've forgotten to offboard. Half this room probably has a security badge of a place that they went into once as a contractor or an employee that they should not have, but you do have somewhere in your rooms. I know. And that's a big problem. And, you know, that's actually a process failure. So our solution actually, I think, targets and tries to solve a lot of the process failures around digitization of information.
So. Good. So, Eileen, what's getting in the way of fixing education? I mean, from the standpoint of you have tools and solutions. Obviously, they're beneficial, they're proven, they work. What's keeping us from fixing the schools?
I think if everyone realized what an investment it was and the ROI on it, people would be a lot more motivated to do it. Like when I think about a smart city or the most efficient thing we can do or the best investment we can make in the city, it's in the people who live in it and making them smarter. There's nothing more secure than a citizenry who can think. But we often see it as a cost and a burden versus an investment. And so when we think about Chicago, for example, I go to meetups where people are complaining about the lack of talent, and then I think about the 422,000 students in CPS who could fill those jobs in very teachable skills that are, again, the skills that we're currently focused on in the city, which is outperforming, by the way, every other district in the U.S., and it's not just our top-performing schools. It's actually, in reading and math, we have more growth than any other district. And so Chicago is figuring out personalized learning at a much faster rate than anybody else, and I think if everyone realized all of the good things happening, our local media covered it more, we would actually become a model of how we can close the opportunity gap, close the achievement gap, and improve the workforce and enable that workforce to be lifelong learners. And obviously the riches that are generated from a, you know, entrepreneurial and well-educated population, we just have many cases throughout history. That is the thing. I think it's just right now we see it as a problem as opposed to an opportunity.
So Ram says kids drop out of college in third grade. Mm-hmm. And what he means is that if we don't intervene early, so where do you think the real pivot point is? Where does it, I mean, I realize 1 through 4 is obviously essential to being a human being, but in terms of the schools, where is the most bang for the buck going to come?
I think research is pointing to grades 4 to 8. That's where the pivot from, you know, imagine that you can drop an iPad into the middle of nowhere and a student can teach themselves basic literacy and basic numeracy. Many of you know kids who have done that, taught themselves how to count and do all sorts of things. The biggest chasm is actually the chasm between that iPad app that can teach you basic alphabet and numbers and the Courseras of the world, or the Outcomes Health Media, where you're sitting in a doctor's office and you can comprehend and consume that information. In between is where most of the world is, which is they lack language resources, background knowledge, and even media literacy skills to be able to consume even a simple infographic. So the biggest pivot point is actually in our grades 4 through 12, and I think that's where also the biggest challenge is. It's very hard stuff to teach and hard stuff to learn, and that's why we tackled it. It was the hardest thing. It was the thing that we couldn't figure out no matter what we did. And personally, I'm really committed to believing that we can close the achievement gap in 3 years no matter where that gap is. We actually produce about 2 years of reading gains beyond average each year. And so in some Chicago public schools, kids who even in kindergarten came in essentially 5 years behind, and by third grade were even further behind, we have closed that achievement gap. And we have lots of data showing that we are now changing the game on high school graduation rates and college and career readiness. So it's a solvable problem, and I think that's the other thing. People think it's too hard to solve, and I'm here to tell you it's being solved right now in our city. It is totally solvable and actually pretty easy to do in comparison to all the other problems that are being created from not solving it.
Cool. So... So you can expect no media coverage of that comment. But, so it wouldn't be a next gen panel if we didn't talk about the fact that nobody under 30 seems to understand what privacy means. So Rishi, talk about privacy in the context of health information, because my view is it's a transaction. You know, if we're laying in the street, we want that paramedic to know that we have an allergy. But if we're seeking a new job, we may not want that employer to know what our medical history is. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, you know, look, it's a big topic in healthcare. You know, because our way of impacting patients is through their providers, our company itself is a little less affected by all of the privacy discourse in our public policy that's going on. Because we help providers use their data. We're not a direct consumer application. But this is big for us. It's big for everybody. Because ultimately, if we want to move to things being personalized, right, you know, you go to any of the major life sciences conferences, and it's extraordinary, the science that's in the pipeline. The science that's out there is already extraordinary, but the stuff that's in the pipeline is even more so. And I think where the world is going is being able to use our clinical data, so our you know, our biology, and being able to overlay that with our preferences. What do we want to get out of our outcomes? There's a lot of data flying around. And I think one of the easy things to say is we want the individual to own the data. And I think that we're on the cusp of that. You know, if you look at FHIR and the protocols go into effect fully next year, patients using their patient portal username and password, this was developed in the last administration, will be able to access their data. So they can log into an app that a company like ours could make, and we wouldn't even need to go through the provider. They own the data, right? So that's been chapter one. But the reason this then gets hard is the utility of the data is in fact in overlaying different panels of it. and then connecting it back into all of these different environments. And oftentimes the regulations aren't even necessarily attempting to be in the way, they're just outdated. So it's just and also, you know, we've interacted with regulatory agencies, they're just understaffed. So there's a whole systemic set of issues that are here around this topic. But I think we're at least in healthcare moving on from the idea of, you know, the data being just your providers. With FHIR and a bunch of other initiatives that are underway, it's going to be possible for consumers to be able to use their own data. But that's going to create its own hotbed of questions about what are the protocols of all these apps and how can they use the data and how can they store the data beyond HIPAA, which is still the prevailing, you know, framework for protection of this data for people.
So, Adam, talk to us about privacy in the cloud.
Yeah, so two aspects of privacy in the cloud, and I want to follow on with something Rishi said. For all the press that it gets about, you know, this company being hacked and that company being hacked, your data is probably safer in the cloud, where there are companies who think about nothing more than how to keep it secure and give you fast access than they are if they're in your own data center. Rishi is 100% right. There is an unprecedented amount of research that's going on around how you keep your data private in one hand, but on the other hand, give you access to it so that you own it. That's Microsoft's philosophy on data, is exactly that. Your data is your data. You own it at the very granular level. You determine who can use it and for what reason and why. I was talking to somebody in Microsoft Research who was working on a type of data protection that is being commonly looked at as possibly the most secure way to hold data and still do stuff with it. It's called homomorphic seal. It's what would happen if you had, picture your data is sitting in a box, and you can't get into this box because it's encrypted, but you want to do some research on that data. Well, what if you could do research and data science on that data without encrypting it? So now you have a box that does data science and a box that holds the data, and the data is never decrypted. So you never have access to the actual data, only the results. That's just one example of the kind of research that's going on in this
case. Thank you all very much, and thanks to the City Club for having us.